Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The first state received over $10 million from the federal government this fall to improve its charter school system.
According to the grant, the state wants to add 3,200 seats to its charter schools in the next 5 years.
Contributor Larry Nagengast joins us with more about the state's plans for those dollars. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also chat with the new head of pediatric health research at Nemours Children's Health System about what new efforts they're making to improve kids' health. Our latest arts playlist introduces us to a local painter whose new exhibition explores identity in a unique way. Plus, we hear more from student journalists at the University of Delaware. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Earlier this fall, the state of Delaware received a three-year, $10.4 million grant from the U.S. Department of Education to improve the state's charter school system. At the time, the Delaware Department of Ed said the money would support sharing best practices between charter schools and other public schools and strengthening the charter school authorization process. It will also provide subgrants to new charter schools for planning and existing charters for expansion. What does all that mean in practice? Contributor Larry Nagengast answers that question in his latest piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me earlier this week to delve into its various pieces.
Before we dive into the specifics of this federal grant, there's a headline here, right? I mean, that is that this grant is supposed to help the state achieve its goal to add charter seats in Delaware. So that begs the question, how many are they looking to add and how are they looking to do that?
Okay, well, according to the grant, the state wants to add 3,200 seats to its charter schools in the next 5 years. It would add 1,200 of those seats by authorizing two new schools to open and the other 2,000 by expanding grade levels at existing schools or by having existing schools replicate their programs at a second location.
That seems pretty ambitious. Can you give us a little context on just how that fits into with overall school enrollment here in the first state?
Follow me with the numbers. I'm throwing a lot at you right now. But currently, there are more than 16,000 students enrolled in charter schools in Delaware. That is about 12% of the 138,000 or so in traditional public and charter schools combined. Now, in the past year, total enrollment in public and charter schools increased by less than 800 students. So now, if enrollment grows at the same pace overall in the next 5 years, that's an addition of about 4,000 students. If you look at it in that context, adding 3,200 students to charter schools isn't likely to occur without a significant percentage either leaving traditional public schools or transferring in from private schools. Now, when I asked officials in the state charter school offices about this, they couldn't break down where the students were likely to come from, and neither could Kendall Massett, the executive director of the Delaware Charter Schools Network. In my view, it may be possible for the charters to add those 3,200 students, but it also seems to me that the charter officials are soft-pedaling the impact that this would have on the traditional public schools.
And it also seems to fly in the face of one issue a number of struggling charters have had in common, and that is meeting their enrollment benchmarks.
Yes, that's true. We've had numerous instances in the last few years of charters struggling to reach 80% of their enrollment projection, and that's the minimum standard that the state uses to determine whether a charter school is viable. In fact, in September, the Delaware Academy for Public Safety and Security closed its doors because it couldn't meet its enrollment minimum. And just this year, three more charters submitted modification requests asking for approval from the state to reduce their enrollment targets by either 5 or 10%. Now, on the other hand, Kendall Massett tells me that there are 8,000 names on charter school waiting lists. Okay, so that to me suggests a couple of things. I think there's a decent amount of duplication of names on these lists. Kids are on waiting lists for Newark Charter and Charter School of Wilmington and some other school, for example. And whether it's a matter of weak performance or lack of interest or poor marketing, there's a decent number of charters that just aren't doing a good job of attracting students.
So with that as kind of the backdrop, let's talk a little bit more about the federal money that's coming to Delaware for charters and how it's going to be doled out. A chunk of this is going to go to this charter expansion effort. How does that look? Your piece suggests there's already some kind of informal sense of where some of this money may wind up.
Well, years ago, there was federal money available to individual charter schools as startup grants, and some Delaware charters took advantage of that. But those funds went away, and now this federal grant is going to help bring some of that back. Charter school people will tell you that there's a lot of front-end expense in opening a school, so the first few years can be really tough. I'm not going to get into the details of those funding issues, but anyhow, the likely grants, $750,000 over 3 years to each of two new schools, will make it easier for them to get over the hump. As for who gets the money, I'm hearing that the new Sussex Montessori School, which has already been approved and is due to open next fall, would qualify as one of the two new charters. A similar amount, $750,000 per school, would be available for four replications, an existing school opening an equivalent program on a second campus. Now, we don't have any schools that have signaled their intention to do that yet. And then there's also money for nine $500,000 grants to existing schools that are adding classrooms or grade levels. Again, among the schools likely to qualify are First State Montessori in Wilmington, which is expanding up to the eighth grade, and two schools that are in the process of building out high school programs, Great Oaks and Odyssey Charter. Also in the mix is a dual language school, Las Americas Aspira Academy, which is going to file a request later on this month for permission to add high school grades starting in 2020.
The applications for these grants are not ready yet, but what will the state be looking for when they are? What will be required of schools that receive this funding?
You know, over the years, there have been a lot of questions surrounding charter schools. People are asking, you know, are there populations of low-income students and English language learners comparable to the traditional public schools in the same area? Are their special education programs adequate? Are there barriers, whether they be real or perceived, that keep students in these groupings from applying? There are also questions about discipline in some charter schools. You know, do the schools do their best to work with problem students, or do they subtly encourage them in one way or another to return to their feeder school? In the grant applications, the state will be looking for assurances that schools will be addressing these issues, that they will serve special education students well, that they will seek to enroll low-income kids and English language learners and do things along those lines.
And this also kind of gets at the question that many people ask about charters, and that is, are they delivering on innovating, collaborating, replicating best practices? What are the people in the charter ecosystem saying about this and how this funding might encourage these kind of big picture goals for charter schools?
Well, you know, over the years, I've heard of several replications and innovations. There's a math program that was used in Kumba Academy in Wilmington that's now being used in the Brandywine School District. And then there was a group of charters that developed their own system for staff evaluations that differed from the one that the state has been using for traditional schools. And I'm told that there are lots of other examples, but I'm hearing that these replications and collaborations that do occur are happening only because people from different schools get together on their own time and figure out how to do the sharing. You know, as they say, time is money. And the charter school people tell me that if they can use grant money to pay staff members at different schools to work together, that will increase the likelihood that they can develop innovative approaches to teaching science, math, reading, and helping English language learners.
What we do know, though, is the state has had its fair share of charter failures, as you outlined in a separate piece this week. What has been learned from those failures, and what's the feeling about the state's process of review and oversight at this point?
Roughly speaking, over the last 5 or 6 years, about one-third of the charters have run into significant academic, administrative, or financial problems, or perhaps all three. Some of the administrative and financial problems have involved criminal behavior. Because of these problems, schools have had to turn in their charters or had their charters revoked, or they've been placed on something called formal review, which is essentially a warning that you either clean up your act or the school is going to be closed down. Now, people in the system, in the charter system, say they think that the state's charter school office is doing a good job of overseeing problem schools once the problems are identified. But people outside the system think that the state could do a better job of identifying problems before these these issues reach a critical stage. And such problems are more likely to occur with newer schools and whenever there's turnover in a school's management team.
Are there some suggestions on how it can be improved, this oversight?
There's a new lead associate, kind of a director of the state's charter school office, Leroy Travers, who used to be the head of another charter school in the state. Now, he's promising there's going to be more of boots on the ground, getting people on his team out into the schools more often so that they have a better feel of what's going on in the charters day to day. Kendall Massett of the Charter Schools Network worries that this formal review process that I mentioned is sort of like putting a target on the back of the school, something that can kind of push it into a downward spiral because it gives the public a bad perception of the institution. So now she's starting to work with charter school leaders on how they might develop their own evaluation system. It would be somewhat like what the state does with it, its annual evaluations, but they try to do it at an earlier stage so that the school leaders, especially those at the newer schools, will be in a better position to identify and resolve and attack problems. You know, and all of this talk from her is really very preliminary. I've got no idea what it might look like when it's done or whether the charter school leaders are going to be able to get together and come up with something that will actually be implemented in some fashion.
And finally, having looked at all this for your piece, what's your take on the overall state of charter schools in Delaware?
Okay, I'm going to say, it's still very much a mixed bag. You know, there are some charters, Wilmington, Newark, MOT, Sussex Academy, for example, that outperform nearby traditional schools in many respects. But I also believe that some of the permitted preferences that affect these schools' demographics are what's helping to drive what appears to be outstanding achievement. I also see other schools that are primarily serving lower income demographics, Coomba, Frieri, Great Oaks, Edison, and East Side in Wilmington, for example, where performance is not necessarily outstanding, but they're showing year-to-year improvement with kids who come to them well below grade level. But there are some things about charters that still trouble me. There's a certain clubbiness, country club feeling about their leadership. You know, you've got individuals who are board members at more than one school. You've got board members who leave the board and then take an administrative job at the same school where they had been on the board. You've got school administrators moving into and out of the state charter school office. Some of these schools are not posting their board minutes promptly on their website. You know, all of that, I mean, just to me anyway, doesn't seem right. You know, I'm also concerned about efficiencies. How many charters are in actual school buildings, buildings that were designed to be schools? Many of them are in retrofitted spaces in former offices and warehouses. Some lack traditional school amenities like gyms and cafeterias. Now, okay, admittedly, this is old news, but there have been millions of dollars spent on construction and rehab projects for charter schools, while there's plenty of open space in traditional public schools. And as I see it, as much as the charter school leaders talk about how they run on tight budgets and so on, this multitude of independently operating charters results in significant inefficiencies that permeate the public school system as a whole. You know, and as far as I know, no one has really made a detailed study, but I'm convinced that this is a big picture problem. Put it all together, what do I see? I see a lot of promise in the academics and some causes for concern on the administrative and the finance side. And I also see that the charter operation is a component of a public school system, but it doesn't always act like it's part of that system.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week on The Green. His piece on charter schools and the new federal dollars to boost them is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next, we'll hear from the new head of pediatric health research at Nemours Children's Health System about its efforts to improve kids' health. Stay with us. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Nemours Children's Health System recently appointed Dr. Mary Lee as its Enterprise Chief Scientific Officer. Dr. Lee is a pediatric endocrinologist with a long history of clinical and laboratory-based research, including long-term environmental research on the health implications of nearby chemical factories on children in a small town in Russia. In her new role, Dr. Lee will lead Nemours efforts to develop better treatments and new cures for children. Lee recently spoke with Delaware Public Media's Nick Schellino about the latest in Nemours medical research.
So you obviously have a long history as a clinical researcher, both studying the hormones prenatally as well as the way the environment affects reproductive development of young people. What other areas of research do you think are at the forefront, I guess, of your agenda and your new role, and where do you see opportunities for Nemours to bolster their research efforts to improve the care of children going forward?
My own efforts were focused on areas of interest to me and related to my expertise, but I think Nemours has the ability to and has already been engaged in a wide range of research that has the ultimate focus of improving child health. Some of it is very much directly focused on child health in Delaware and looking at the particular situation of children in this region, and some are advances and research that's looking at broader populations of childhood wellness and disease. So I think we could start with prevention and thinking about prenatal influences and environmental influences, you know, social determinants of health. And we have a group that is looking at that, and I think that's going to continue to be an area of major focus and will become even more robust here over the next few years. These groups are looking at situations such as, you know, how does housing and access to food security and adverse childhood experiences, how does that affect childhood health? And so these are some of our community-based researchers. We have a few people who are starting to look at and try to understand the best way to help infants who are born to addicted mothers and how to leverage that time. It's well recognized that pregnant women are very motivated to change, and that is an opportune time to try to work with them to help with, you know, addiction and try to help them work at improving those behaviors and those habits. And then we're looking with collaborators at that up at Jefferson, as well as at the treatment of the infants and children who are at risk, both because they're exposed and because they are, you know, with parents who may have risky behaviors. And in the worst cases, they're, you know, are in, you know, sort of foster care situations, which is another type of risk. So that's one area that we will be focusing on. How do these things affect childhood diseases like asthma, like obesity, you know, risk for diabetes, and what can we do to intervene at a very early stage and try to alter and affect well-being and health in kind of non-traditional ways, working with the state, with community groups, and with activists and folks in the community. So that's one area of research that I think will be growing. The other is our focus on understanding and identifying disease early on so that we can treat and ameliorate the devastating consequences. And so these are some of those conditions, the genetic and metabolic diseases, that can be very difficult to diagnose because they're rare and they have a complex phenotype. So the best example of this are the Dover Amish or the Amish and Mennonite population in the Lancaster area, and how do we help to identify these early so that those children who are treatable can be treated early and avoid the devastating consequences that occur rapidly and are irreversible. So we have a study that has just been launched and is funded through the Delaware CTR, which is an NIH-funded grant that funds research across institutions in Delaware with one partner in South Carolina. So it entails the University of Delaware, Christiana, Nemours, and now Dell State. So through that funding mechanism, we funded one of our physicians, Matt Domesco, to work with our research team here as well as the geneticists up in Lancaster to develop a panel and try to identify what genetic conditions are present in the Dover community. You know, we have a brand new clinic that we set up in Dover to treat the 2,000 or so individuals, Amish individuals who live in that region. So this grant is to see what genetic diseases this community is at risk for and to screen early so that infants are picked up quite early. It's similar to the newborn screening that's done for thyroid and other diseases, but this is a very complex genetic panel that's, you know, tied in with our precision medicine initiative and is a unique tool that if it is successfully identifying diseases early and proves to be a useful tool, we can then expand to some of the other Amish communities around the country. So those are some of the areas I see that we're going to be pursuing and delving into in more depth over the next few years.
And what does that look like? You mentioned grant funding in the case of the genetic study regarding the Mennonite population here in Dover. When you're looking at either a study like that, or you also mentioned prenatal care of substance-exposed infants and the plans of safe care following the birth event, where do you see opportunities to bolster those efforts in Nemours? Is it through grant funding and resources like that?
Yeah, it's going to be through a combination of internal resources and grant funding. All of those projects are partially funded by Nemours and partially funded by external funding. So, you know, there are foundations that we look to. Sometimes individuals have a wish to see progress in a particular disease, so we have some philanthropic sources of funding to pursue research related to a specific category of disease or disease entity. We have grants from foundations. We engage in multi-center therapy trials that can be funded by pharmaceutical companies or by NIH. And then we have a number of folks who have successfully obtained NIH funding for their research. So it's right now we have about a little bit more than 20 million a year that Nemours is investing in research, and we are getting probably about 15 million in external grants and funding.
Well, in addition to the funding, let's switch it to the technology side of it. Nemours, along with lots of providers here in the state of Delaware, are trying to bolster their use of digital technology. This includes electronic medical records, telemedicine, and these are being touted as resources to track patient data, certainly in the case of value-based care contracts, where providers are looking to have financial contracts with insurers that concentrate on the outcome, the health outcomes of patients rather than fee for service. Are these resources also valuable on the research side of it to be used to track patient data in that way to do research and maybe develop better treatments going forward?
Yes, definitely. I think almost all of the Delaware healthcare organizations are submitting data, and you know, we're creating the DIN, which is a Delaware Healthcare Information Network. And so this is going to really let us monitor patients that are seen and understand whether we are effectively providing care in emergency rooms, urgent care centers through pediatricians, how we're coordinating care across the state. Another example of how digital technology is going to help us understand and improve care is the PEDSnet, which is a collaboration of 8 large pediatric hospitals across the nation. So Nemours is one, Boston Children's, Colorado Children's, Philadelphia Children's, and we've all agreed to submit de-identified data to this database so that we can understand how and use this information to improve healthcare. So we've just published a paper from this that was able to show for the first time that obesity in children is a risk factor for asthma, and that suggests interplay of different factors on health and on ability to manage and control asthma. We're also using the PEDSnet for other studies that take advantage of this very, very large database and can use it to better understand how we're delivering care and, you know, what we can be doing to improve care.
Thanks to Dr. Mary Lee, the new Enterprise Chief Scientific Officer at Nemours Children's Health System, and our Nick Schellino for their time on The Green this week. Our latest arts playlist is next. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Wilmington resident and painter Lauren E. Peters has a new exhibition of self-portraits on display at the Mezzanine Gallery in the Carvel State Office Building in Wilmington. It's called Ship of Theseus. Peters calls it a reference to a thought experiment that raises the question of whether a ship, standing in for any object in general, that has all of its components replaced, remains fundamentally the same object. In this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele discusses with Peters how her series of self-portraits attempts to explore that concept and how it relates to identity.
Hey, give me some of your background before we talk about the new exhibition of self-portraits.
Sure. I'm from Wilmington, Delaware, and I did go away to school and majored in art, but it was always something I thought that, you know, someday I'd get around to doing it. And even when I started painting again, which was about 4 years ago, it was, you know, this seemed like a fun exercise. Had no idea that painting self-portraits would be kind of my predominant focus right now. But, you know, I had no idea the wealth of information and inspiration that would be available through doing this. So I Yeah, I'm really enjoying where this is going.
How did you get into art and particularly self-portraits? Why is that interesting to you?
I had always kind of been interested in identity and just, you know, in terms of gender or like the idea of self. And this is something that all kind of came together. It just through, I was looking through an art magazine, and I saw this painter who I was not familiar with named Chantal Joffe, and she painted these self-portraits, and there was something about what she did, and our styles are very different, but her use of color and her specificity with clothing, which I've always been interested in fashion as well, really seemed like something I could get into. And I'd actually been painting for my thesis in college from I had a plaster cast of the Venus de Milo in my studio. So I did a bunch of things, like kind of using her as a symbol for, you know, a lot of the things that I was interested in. And after college, I looked for a very long time for another plaster cast or some sort of garden statue or just really anything that, you know, could be, again, like my muse. And I never once thought to turn that inward or use myself, but it turns out like I'm just the perfect model to be able to use to project these things onto.
All right, so Greek and Roman references and the understanding of self-identity have been recurring themes in your work. Your choice of the exhibition title, Ship of Theseus, is a reference to thought experiment that raises the question of whether a ship, standing for an object in general that has had all of its components replaced, remains fundamentally the same object. Can you delve into that a little bit and put it into layman's terms for my listeners?
Sure. I mean, I think it's interesting in terms of what I'm doing, because I put on all these costumes, like I wear wigs, I like, you know, somewhat alter my appearance to keep it interesting. So I was always trying to get at the root of, like, what is the real self? So it's interesting to me in terms of the thought experiment of the Ship of Theseus, you know, if I replace certain parts of myself or put on different things or take away different things, you know, does that get at what, you know, the real me? Or, you know, is it, I don't know, I'm interested in like the taking away or the adding on and what that does to whatever your idea of the core of yourself is.
So do people look at your costumes and think of them as disguises?
I think I try to explain it in a way that they're not looking at it like that. I think just if you're looking at them on the surface, they just seem fun. And sometimes I do, you know, need to point out that the fact that they are self-portraits, they're not always, you know, obvious. And, yeah.
Is this your first exhibit in the Mezzanine Gallery?
It sure is. I was awarded a fellowship from the Delaware Division of the Arts to be an emerging artist of 2018. So this show was offered to me as a part of that grant.
Well, congratulations on that. Where else in the past have you exhibited your work?
My goodness, I've had quite a year. I think this is my ninth show this year. I think we've tried to tally it up recently. I've been all over, and thanks to the fellowship from the DDOA, they actually arranged a show where my work would travel to all three counties in Delaware. So started off the summer at the Biggs Museum of American Art in Dover, then traveled down to Camp Rehoboth. I had a painting and a group show down there with all of the other award winners, and then came back up to Cab Calloway School of the Arts in Wilmington. So that was exciting. I mean, I had a couple paintings at DCAD in a group show. I regularly show at the Delaware Contemporary, which is where I have my studio. And there's a little gallery in there that is all the studio artists get to show in there once a year. So just had a very busy year.
It sounds like it, definitely. Yeah. We're talking to Lauren Peters, painter Lauren Peters. Her exhibit, her exhibition, Ship of Theseus, an exhibition of self-portraits on display right now through the end of the month at the Mezzanine Gallery. Lauren, what do you want people to take away from this exhibit?
You know what? It's even just on the surface, it's a really fun show. We hung it. So by the time you will be hearing this, the show is already up. I think somebody's working on lighting, maybe as we speak. So it's great to see everything together. I use a lot of fun colors. I mean, there's that. And then there's also the, you know, if you want to delve a little deeper, there's the idea of, you know, relating how you view yourself in terms of seeing how someone else, you know, tries to explain how they see themselves.
After this exhibition closes on December 28th, where do you go next?
Great question. my next big solo exhibit I actually have on the books for November of 2019. In between then and now, I know things come up frequently, but after this whirlwind year, I'm actually looking forward to taking a little bit of time and maybe, you know, make some paintings not under the gun and, you know, really take time. I'm interested more in, like, the crafting of maybe some of the garments that I wear in the paintings. There's some things that I just haven't had time for this year because I've just tried to take advantage of every opportunity that's come up, that I'm going to just try to be a lot more conscious about what I'm creating and, you know, maybe just taking a few days to figure out what I would like to do as opposed to just, you know, going with the flow.
Where can people read more about Lauren E. Peters?
I'm a very active Instagram user, and right now that's been mostly where I've just been keeping things up to date. I have somebody, this is another thing that I need to do in 2019, is work on my website. I've got everything lined up to photograph all these new paintings and somebody who's going to design it for me. So that is something to look forward to. It's going to be laurenepeters.com. And then on Instagram, I'm lauren.e.peters.
Thanks to painter Lauren E. Peters and R. Kelly Steele for their time in this week's Arts Playlist. And we have links to places you can learn more about Peters at delawarepublic.org if you want to delve more into her work. And The Green concludes in just a moment with another visit to the University of Delaware to hear work from student journalists. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Last week, we took you to the University of Delaware to highlight work created by students there. This week, we returned to Newark to hear from more student voices at UD, telling stories about issues and topics they find interesting and important. These pieces were produced by UD Communication students for a class taught by Nancy Karabjanian, longtime First Aid journalist, director of UD's Center for Political Communication, and one of the founders of Delaware Public Media. We start with Emma Scholes. The junior communications major suggests that when you think of living in a hotel, you might think of relaxing spas, breakfast buffets, room service, or even a beautiful view. But that's not what came to mind for a group of UD students when they were told just weeks before returning to campus they would be living in hotels.
The lobby of the Spring Hill Suites Hotel in downtown Newark looks clean, with white panels and a modern-day vibe. The hotel expects to see an influx of guests during Parents' Weekend and Homecoming, but not the first few weeks of the fall semester.
But then, like, a week or two before we moved in, they were like, actually, it won't be done until September. So we had no backup plan because we were really planning on moving in by, like, the 21st, the latest.
That was Sabrina Lopez, a junior at UD who planned on living in an off-campus townhouse. But her soon-to-be home was still under construction well into the summer.
So, like, we were driving one day, and we're like, they didn't do, like, the roof, they didn't do this, they didn't do that, like, it's not even built yet. So we were, like, freaking out, but they didn't say anything to us.
Sabrina, along with 12 other UD students, received an email in early August bearing the news that the Spring Hill Suites would be their home for the first part of the semester. Sophomore Elizabeth Molinaro was also one of those 12.
It was great the first couple of weeks, the first week or two, because we got our beds made, we had free breakfast, but then it started getting hard when the workload, like, you know, picked up.
Both Elizabeth and Sabrina were placed in hotel rooms with two other girls. The rooms included two beds, a couch, and only one light.
Like, we all had to go to bed at the same time. One person at, like, 8 a.m., so she woke up at 6, and the other person in class at 3:30, so she would try to wake up, like 10, but someone's trying to get ready, like, literally right next to you.
But this was not the only struggle. The hotel is about a 30-minute walk from campus. For students not willing to make the hour-long round trip, food and rest between classes also became a problem. In addition to being unable to return to the hotel during the day, the hotel rooms were only equipped with a microwave, making eating out the only option. Privacy was also limited, which made returning to the hotel at the end of the day even more undesirable.
We had no privacy, so like if someone was like in a bad mood or trying to do work, it was a mess.
Living in the hotel did come with a few benefits, like continental breakfast and coming home to a made bed. The real bonus, though, were the friendships formed along the way.
We did make friends with the hotel people. They were really, really great. Like, we had Phyllis. She worked the front desk. She was awesome. She was the sweetest person. Like, every time we walked in, she had, like, a smile. She was like, good morning, ladies. And we went out. She's like, are you guys going out? Like, have fun. Like, she was so sweet.
And front desk associate Phyllis Smith-Tiller feels the same about her student guests.
I was elated to have them. To me, it was a great experience to have those young girls here.
The girls were finally able to move into their townhouses after more than 2 months of living in the hotel. For them, it wasn't an ideal way to start the semester, but clearly a memorable experience. I'm Emma Scholes.
Thanks to UT junior Emma Scholes. Next up is junior communications major Delaney Tatitsa, who tells us while swing dance may date back to the roaring 20s, it still comes alive weekly at UD.
5, 6, 5, 6, 7, right, left.
Counting right. The beat and doing the Lindy Hop, the Delaware Swing Club dances into action every Friday night in Perkins. Kate Holden, president of the club, takes charge.
So we specifically do Lindy Hop, which started in Harlem in the 1920s, and that's what we focus on as a club. It's an improvisational dance primarily. It was born out of the social dance floor and very much born out of people messing around on the dance floor and seeing what happened.
The club consists of around 80 members and continues to grow. Since it's open to the public, new members are constantly showing up to practice, eager to learn some new moves.
Step, touch, back, up.
Connor Trainer, treasurer of the Swing Club, gushes about why he's been a member for over a year now.
We're such a close, tight-knit community, and we're all, like, really nice and, like, open and caring about each other. So that's pretty much the reason why I've stayed so long.
On Sundays from 1:30 to 4:30, and Wednesdays from 9 to 11, the Swing Club holds workshops where general swing dance moves are taught to those who attend. Although this style of dance is primarily improvisation, the club's goal is to give everyone an idea of what types of steps to take, so they can lead and follow with their partner or the rest of the group.
Anyone can do this dance. Like I said, I joined because I was a terrible dancer, and we teach you everything you need to know. You just come out and you have a great time, and it's wonderful.
This is Delaney Tatitsa.
Thanks to junior comm major Delaney Tatitsa. And we stick with the musical theme with junior comm major Rachel Stamberg, who delved into the world of a cappella at UD, telling us students involved in the Crescendos work to balance their hectic schedules with their love for music and the fellowship it can create.
1, 2, 3, 4.
That's the Crescendos, one of the University of Delaware's 8 a cappella groups rehearsing. The group's members put a lot of time and effort into the group, resulting in friendships and fun, but requiring a lot of hard work. However, the impact of the group goes beyond the music. Kiki Foster, a current senior at UD, would not have been a music major if it weren't for Crescendo.
I didn't start out a music major, but then after I was seeing all this time I was devoting to crescendo and how it was kind of what I was happiest and best at doing, it kind of led me to my major, so I kind of accredited that to my time here.
For Kiki, a cappella was something she always knew she wanted to do.
Well, I've been doing a cappella since freshman year of high school, and so I wanted to continue that in college, like at the higher level, because I saw like the potential of a cappella and how really unique it could be.
Any a cappella group is time-consuming, and being in one as a student can be very difficult, but these students are making it work.
If you love something, then you're going to make it work, and I think that's kind of the case for everybody, but I know that it does get hard sometimes.
That's John Quigley, Crescendo's music director. For him, his a cappella group is more than just a place to sing.
It's also helped me be able to communicate with people and know how to, like, read people.
For John, being a part of Crescendo taught him how to lead, giving him the confidence to be music director. But beyond leadership, being a part of this group, rehearsing three times a week, creates a bond, something Dominique Ceretti feels makes it all worth it.
We really all believe that our group is kind of a family, and so if we're not in rehearsal, we're hanging out together, or we're talking, or like, there's literally no point in time where I'm not like somehow like in contact with someone in Crescendo.
I'm Rachel Stamberg.
Thanks to junior Rachel Stamberg. And we wrap things up with senior communications major Jessica Cooper. She reports that when students seek to teach after college, the most common path includes earning a master's in education. But she found for some, Teach for America puts a new spin on becoming an educator.
Elementary students load their backpacks with homework assignments and lunch leftovers. It's the end of the school day. The student teachers there are taking the standard route to the classroom, a degree and a master's in education. But that's not the only path. Teach for America coordinator Amelia Ablemeyer at the University of Delaware wants UD students to try the Teach for America way.
Teach for America is an organization that strives to overcome educational inequity by enlisting, developing, and mobilizing as many as possible of the United States' top leaders across the country, and effectively strengthen the movement for educational equity and excellence. And Teach for America employs leaders from these universities to serve 2 years in disadvantaged areas and teach and really improve the overall system of our education.
Amelia recruited her roommate, Ruby Snyderman, who became a core member for Teach for America after seeing Amelia's passion, which resonated with her and inspired her to apply.
Core member is a teacher on the Teach for America team that is selected from a top university. They have the leadership experience and drive to help overcome our country's educational inequity.
Back in the classroom, Emily Fisher, a student teacher from UD, is on the traditional path.
I'm a student teacher, so my job is to assist around the classroom, and throughout the semester we're teaching different lessons and eventually teaching every lesson every day for 2 weeks for our lead week. We've got to see all different types of schools, whether that's low income or higher education or different grade levels. So I think they've prepared us a lot, but I think going through student teaching really teaches us what it's going to be like in the future.
The main difference, your major. Teach for America accepts students of all majors and gives you after college plans that we all dread of finding. As a human services major, that works just fine for Ruby.
After my 2 years as a core member, I want to be a school guidance counselor. And Teach for America will give me a lot of experience of being in a school and learning the different dynamics and how things work and really getting a feel for different types of kids and how to interact with them.
For Amelia, she will be attending the University of Pennsylvania post-grad to gain her master's and work at a school in Philly for Teach for America.
I'm going to be receiving a full salary and same benefits as a teacher normally would, as well as get support from Teach for America professionals and peers that are going through the same experience as me as well.
In 2016, Teach for America employed 16 students to dedicate their post-grad towards solving the problem of education inequity. I'm Jessica Cooper.
Thanks to UD senior Jessica Cooper, as well as juniors Emma Scholes, Delaney DeTita, and Rachel Stamberg, for offering us a glimpse into student life at the University of Delaware. And that's it for this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Larry Nagengast, UD students Jessica Cooper, Delaney DeTita, Emma Scholes, and Rachel Stamberg, and Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us. The Green is going to take a few weeks off for the holidays. We hope you enjoy them too. And we'll be back in January with more of The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.